I'm Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty, and we've decided to do a podcast called We Don't Have to Choose. Why that title? Well, several years ago, I heard Rachel Barco give a presentation at the University of Minnesota, and she said that if the criminal legal system was a private corporation, it would have been bankrupt years ago. And that got me to thinking, why? Why does the criminal legal system not work to keep us safe? And what will keep us safe? That's what we're going to talk about on the podcast, that we don't have to choose between public safety and reform or changes or advancement, that those things we are trying to do here at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office will bring us public safety. So welcome to Alec Karakatsanis. I am so excited to have you on the podcast, in part because even when I was in the first chapter of your book, Copaganda, I was thinking about how much it described my about 2.5 years as Hennepin County attorney. So welcome, Alec.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Alec, can you tell us just a little bit about your background?
Yes, I started my career as a public defender in Alabama, and I was working in federal court, defending people who were accused of federal crimes who couldn't afford to pay for a lawyer. And actually, prior to that, I worked for a year for a federal judge. And then I went to the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia for 3 years, where I was a public defender in Washington, D.C. And then in 2014, I got a grant from Harvard Law School to start my own nonprofit organization. And the idea with that was to work on the issues that I cared about, public safety and civil rights and sort of the incredible brutality and injustice that I had seen and that my clients and communities had experienced in the criminal punishment bureaucracy. And the idea was to start a new kind of nonprofit organization that could use civil rights laws to challenge these injustices on a more systemic basis, but also to work with communities and people who are directly impacted and organizers and public officials, and especially journalists and artists and musicians and writers and other people to really not only attack these injustices like inside the courtroom, but to maybe try to change the way our society thinks about punishment as a solution to what are really social problems and economic and political problems. And so I was very fortunate to be able to quit my job and to start doing that work. And I've been doing it for over 10 years. And we've been filing lawsuits and building partnerships with people across the country. Our cases have gotten hundreds of thousands of people out of jail. We've reunited thousands of families. We've gotten tens of millions of dollars back for some of the most vulnerable people in our society from big companies and governments that had sort of turned their local court systems into debt collection systems. We've done a lot of prosecutor misconduct work. We've done a lot of police brutality and misconduct and surveillance work. And so now we're sort of a larger national organization that really tries to resensitize our culture, right? After decades of mass human caging, a lot of people in our society are just used to this level of government intrusion in our society, and they're used to all these multi-billion dollar industries that profit from that. And so one of the things that we try to do is say to people in a variety of ways inside the courtroom and outside the courtroom, none of this is normal. Most other societies, and indeed for most of U.S. history, we didn't have this kind of sprawling punishment bureaucracy. At the end of the day, our work is actually quite simple. We're trying to show people that like none of these systems are actually about keeping anybody safe, and they're actually not very good at it. And there's lots of other things that we can do to improve overall flourishing and safety for people and their families and communities.
That's actually why it fits in really well. So the name of this podcast is We Don't Have to Choose. And one of the things I've tried to talk about as county attorney is that people want to frame any kind of reform work as being soft on crime.
you know, like there's tough on crime and there's reform work and they're very far apart. And I've tried to focus on like, you don't have to choose because actually the criminal legal system has not kept anybody safe. It's created huge disparities. And the things that some of us are trying to do actually by data, all of that kind of thing, do keep us safer. Although there are also issues with that. I want you, so you wrote a book called Unusual Cruelty, which we're not going to talk a lot about, but I want to recommend to people because it really does challenge those assumptions. You know, there has been a lot of normalization of what we've been sold as, you know, the criminal legal system keeps us safe. And I highly recommend Unusual Cruelty for somebody who is open to being challenged about their assumptions and really think about, so why do we do that? So that's an excellent book.
Thank you so much. Yeah, when I was trying to think about the intervention I wanted to make with Usual Cruelty, I was really interested in helping people understand what this legal system is actually doing. You know, for example, I think a lot of people have bought this kind of propaganda from the second half of the 20th century. By the way, this is not something that the police and the prosecutors and prison system really did for a long time. They didn't feel the need to tell certain stories about what they did. They didn't market themselves as really being about public safety at all. They were much more honest about what they were doing. But in the second half of the 20th century, we started seeing things like, you know, slogans on the side of police cars and what has now evolved into the multi-billion dollar policing public relations industry, where most major police departments spend millions and millions of dollars every year on just officers who do propaganda work. You know, I was just talking to some people from Los Angeles. You know, the sheriff in Los Angeles, for example, is just one example, has 42 full-time public relations propaganda officers, right? In Chicago, where I was just a little bit earlier on my book tour, you know, when the police killed Laquan McDonald, they had 4 full-time public relations officers. And after that cover-up and the sort of public relations nightmare for the police, they steadily started increasing it. And today, a decade later, they have over 50 full-time officers working on propaganda and public relations. But that was not the case for a long time. The police used to be much more open and honest that they were and like they are in every other country and every other society in history, the armed government agents serve the interests of whoever has power in a society. And so in societies that are really unequal, people who have a lot of money have a lot of power. And so throughout U.S. history, since police forces were originally sort of conceived in the form that we know them now, they were, you know, originally came out of patrols for enslaved people who ran away. And they also, in much of the rest of the country, they sort of evolved out of corporate security forces that were trying to crush striking low-wage laborers. And they were really honest about that function. They were sort of the tool of the local political machine to do the bidding of people who had a lot of power and money. And then in the second half of the 20th century, they became what we call professionalized. They started seeking a lot more money, right? And they started having all these messages. And so today, they call themselves, you know, it's very important to the police. They call themselves, you probably heard this term, law enforcement, right? Now, law enforcement is a term of propaganda. A lot of prosecutors have started calling themselves, you know, law enforcement as well. Now, this is a term that's meant to convey some kind of objectivity or neutrality, right? Meanwhile, and what I was trying to do in the first book, Usual Cruelty, is to say, look, in any society, whether it's the United States or any other country, or whether it's the 1910s or 1940s or 1970s or 2020s, societies decide what conduct is criminal and what conduct isn't. It's not neutral. So you can have a society where it's a crime to get an abortion, or it's a crime to hoard wealth. It's a crime to charge interest. It's a crime to join a union. It's a crime to refuse to join a union, right? Societies are constantly making decisions that are linked to their own sort of social, political, and cultural context. So, for example, you might think it could be a crime to sexually harass someone at work, Our society has chosen to handle that through that's called the civil system, right? Even though it causes a lot of harm, right? But then much more importantly is the idea that once you've determined what a crime is, the police only enforce some crimes against some people some of the time in some places. It's not like a law is violated and automatically it's enforced. This is why, for example, there for the last 40 years, there have been violent drug raids by the police in poor communities, disproportionately Black communities, immigrant communities across the United States. But there's never violent drug raids at wealthy boarding schools or Yale University or J.P. Morgan investment banking parties, right? Or, you know, there could be a fight at a sort of public school and the police are called and now the children are brought. That fight is processed as a quote unquote crime and it's handled through the criminal punishment system. The child might be removed from the home and sent to one of our country's really horrific juvenile caging facilities. Whereas a fight at a private high school in town might result in a call to the parents or something like that, right? So crimes are not enforced. And then there's a ton of crimes that are just completely ignored.
Can I jump in on that?
Yeah.
Because I think I know where you're going too. And this has been kind of a frustration that I've had. We created a worker protection unit. And the idea there would be to use all of our tools, civil and criminal, to be able to prosecute, if it seems appropriate, wage theft. And those kind of economic crimes. And one of the challenges there is that if somebody feels that they're, well, first of all, a lot of those people who are the victims of that are very vulnerable. Some of them are immigrants, but some of them, you know, if you're the victim of wage theft, who do you actually call? Because if you call police, traditionally, they will say that's a civil thing. We don't do that. And it is true, many of the police departments just don't investigate that. They wouldn't know how to respond. And so can you, and we, by way of context too, I'm Hennepin County Attorney, which means Minneapolis and its suburbs. We have about 38-ish different law enforcement entities. But can you talk a little bit about that in terms of, we got lots of economic crimes, but are those being enforced? And even we do have a wage theft statute here in Minnesota. And we just got the very first wage theft conviction in Minnesota about 3 months ago.
Wow. Yeah, this is one of the things I talk about a lot in my new book, Copaganda, which is really about the various propaganda tactics that get us to focus on the harms committed by some people, but to ignore much more significant harms committed by other people. So, you know, the news has us focused, for example, on shoplifting. And in fact, at a time when shoplifting was down and property crime was at historic lows, it created a national panic about retail theft and shoplifting. At the same time, and in the book, I have some really, I think, hilarious examples and also really revealing examples about this. One of the key things is that the volume of news articles affects how urgently we see a problem. So, you know, you could have hundreds of news stories about retail theft and zero stories about wage theft, even though wage theft around the country is about a $50 billion problem. So it's not just bigger than retail theft. It's about five times bigger than all of the property crime that the FBI reports around the country combined. And wage theft is just small potatoes. If you start talking about tax evasion or corporate fraud, so tax evasion is about $1 trillion a year. So that's about 60 times all of the property crime that police and the FBI focus on, right? Or corporate fraud, about $800 billion. So this is crime on a scale that is truly hard to fathom. And people are not made to feel urgently about it, even though it is determining the course of their lives. It's determining the kind of healthcare they get. It's determining whether the products give them cancer. It's determining whether they and their families can afford diapers and food. It's determining virtually every corner of society in terms of how and what we invest in. Anyway, I could go on and on. But the wage theft issue that you bring up is incredibly interesting because all over the country, police and prosecutors are brought examples of employers stealing people's wages. And this is a crime, even in places that don't have a specific wage set, it's still a crime. It's still a form of fraud. There's a bunch of different crimes that it fits in different places. And it's never, very rarely treated like that by quote-unquote law enforcement officials. It's one of those crimes that's basically ignored. And this gets to a point that you mentioned a little bit earlier, which I want to just, I think it's so important. There's two defining features of people who call themselves tough on crime. Number one, those people want to ignore the crimes committed by the most powerful people in our society. So almost without fail, people who call themselves tough on crime, they basically immunize and ignore crimes committed by corporations, whether it's air pollution, which is an intentional crime all over the country, which kills 100,000 people a year. So that's five times all homicide combined. And a lot of it is just criminal. Same with water pollution, just spewing stuff into our rivers and streams and lakes and groundwater, killing people, giving children horrific diseases, right? I mean, interestingly, the lead poisoning also has been shown to be one of the leading factors in increasing rates of violence in society. So it's actually affecting police-reported crime too. But the people who are tough on crime want to actually not regulate any of those things, not prosecute any of those things. They divest from, they remove the positions of any investigators who are even looking into that, right? And then they immunize them, and those prosecutors' offices don't go after those things. They are actually, you know, using their own terminology, they're soft on crime committed by powerful people. And so they want to, the first feature of these people is they want to ruthlessly crush the most vulnerable people in our society through low-level, high-volume prosecution and arresting and whatever, right? But they want to immunize the conduct of the most powerful people in our society. It's why throughout the tough-on-crime era, there were literally hundreds of thousands of rape kits all over the country that police and prosecutors just chose not to test. They chose not to look at sexual assault in our society in any kind of systemic way. Instead, they pursued high volume nonviolent drug crimes, right? And there are a lot of reasons for that. They made a lot more money off of that through overtime, through civil forfeiture, through federal grant funding that was contingent on the number of arrests, not the type of arrest, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the second thing I want to say about the tough on crime people is that it's kind of like a modern flat earther movement. The policies that they're pursuing have actually been shown to increase even the narrow range of crimes that they themselves focus on. And that's because the things that determine how much people hurt each other in any society are not like whether the Hennepin County DA prosecutes 62% of the cases police bring them, or like the predecessor, you know, prosecutes, you know, a few percentage points more, or whatever it is. I don't know what your numbers are, but like the difference between the percentage of cases you're prosecuting or, you know, the median sentence, is it 4 years or 7 years, right? Or are there 13 officers on patrol in this neighborhood or 16? Those things that the people are constantly arguing about in the local news, that's a form of propaganda, because the difference between those is not responsible for shifts in how much people hurt each other in a society. The levels of violence and harm in any given society are much more dependent on, you know, how much money people have. Are they poor? What are the levels of inequality? Do they have jobs? Do they have access to healthcare and treatment? Do they have safe places to live? Are there after-school programs for their kids? Are there community ties, or are people isolated and alone? I can go on and on and on. I talk in the book about all these actually deep structural factors that determine how much people hurt each other.
So, Alec, let's jump into, we have been talking about a little bit, but copaganda. And off the top of my head, so you were talking about retail theft. And I remember the video coming out of San Francisco that was played over and over and over. Like, I think it was a Walgreens And you would have thought that retail theft, and it was characterized by the media, retail theft, out of control, therefore, there were a lot of things that therefore need to happen. The other one is very recent there's a horrific, just a horrific murder on a bus or train. Do you know which one I mean?
Yeah.
And that's played over and over and over on social media. And that is portrayed as there are people waiting to murder you everywhere. I mean, those are two examples of what I would say copaganda. Can you, you know, explain what you mean by copaganda? Maybe comment on those two examples.
Copaganda is a special type of propaganda that really does three things. You know, it narrows our conception of safety and threat. So it's very, very focused on the kinds of crimes that the police associate with the poorest and most vulnerable people of our society, and also strangers and immigrants, et cetera, right? So it focused on a very particular kind of crime, as opposed to the much larger types of crimes that we were just talking about that are actually the things that are they're most significant in determining the safety and well-being of people. So if we were actually interested in creating public safety for everyone, we'd have to make some pretty big changes in some structural features of our society that aren't necessarily the preferred policies of people who have a lot of money and power. So the first thing propaganda does is it narrows our conception. It's constantly having us focused on the most marginalized people. The second thing it does is it having focused on a very narrow range of police reported crime, it constantly makes us think that crime is going up, 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 up. That's why over the last 25 years in public polling, every single year, people say crime is going up, even though almost every single year crime is going down to the point where we now have historic lows in police reported crime. But the third and most important thing it does is it tells us that the solution, all of our fears, and this is why it's particularly dangerous and responsible for the rise of authoritarian moment that we're in, because it constantly tells us that the solution to our fears is not what the evidence shows. It's not investing in our communities and, you know, improving the health and well-being of our quality, et cetera, the child education, all the things that the evidence shows. It actually steers us away from those things. And the solution to all of our problems is always more and more and more and more investment in the punishment bureaucracy, police, prosecutors, breaking down the multi-billion dollar industries profit. And this story you told about shoplifting was really interesting because it's an example of what I call the selective curation of anecdote and the volume of news. Both stories you talked about, actually, right? So what do I mean by that? Let's say, I guess we're in Minnesota. So let me give an example related to Minnesota. Let's say like you asked me to describe to someone who's not from Minnesota, you know, Anthony Edwards, the basketball player, you know, I could make a montage of Anthony Edwards' career and I could choose only his missed shots. So I could make you like a 5-hour montage of him just missing shot after shot after shot after shot after shot. And if I took that montage, I could then show you the video if you've never seen him play. And you might think he's a terrible shooter and a really bad basketball player, right? And this is the key to really good propaganda. The best propaganda, at least propaganda that's targeted at liberal audiences, is using true facts, but curating them in a way that creates a false impression, right? So I can take a very, very good basketball player, one of the best basketball players in the world, but by curating only true facts about the times he missed his shots, I can make him seem like a really bad basketball player. That's what the news media does with retail theft. That's how it can convey to people that retail theft is going on by the time when it's actually going down. That's how it can make people feel really scared about retail theft, even though they're not actually any more at risk of shoplifting or retail theft than they were a year ago or 2 years ago or whatever, right? And the selective curation of anecdote is, so it matters which anecdotes we choose to bombard the public with in high volume, right? The public would be really, really differently situated if, for example, every single night on the news, instead of a mugshot of, you know, a poor person or a person of color who committed a crime, they had you know, a bad landlord of the day segment, you know, like what are the worst landlords in Minneapolis doing every single day, right? Telling those stories or, you know, which CEOs spewed the most chemicals into the air and is responsible for the most deaths, right? So I'm just saying the news media every single day, there's millions of things that happen the night before, and they have to decide which 12 to 14 things am I going to tell people about and what am I going to ignore? And when you curate those anecdotes and then you bombard people with them, so like the transit killing you're talking about, thousands and thousands of stories about that in the days after, right? Bombarded people with it. And so that affects people's brain chemistry. And it's selective curation of anecdote that's very similar to the famous William Horton ads in the 1988 presidential election, where a lot of people remember that George Bush bombarded Dukakis with these images of this black man who was released on a furlough program and was accused of a brutal killing afterward. And by the way, that furlough program was enormously successful. The evidence showed it was actually public safety increasing because it helped reestablish family ties, et cetera. And they started getting rid of furlough programs across the country, which is a policy that went against the evidence because they had so thoroughly scared people with that one anecdote. And the thing I like to remind people of is it wasn't just some Republican presidential candidate who got that story and told this racist story or whatever. That story came into the public consciousness because a local newspaper did 200 stories on it and forced its way through high volume coverage into the public discourse. And they won the Pulitzer Prize for this reporting. So the same thing that's remembered as a racist moment in U.S. political history was actually celebrated in the mainstream journalism world with one of its highest awards. And that is one of the problems with propaganda. These propaganda tactics are so entrenched and so normalized that people don't even see them. And in fact, they're often rewarded by the mainstream media.
So one thing I find fascinating, and it was certainly true here in Minneapolis. Minneapolis is DFL, Democratic Farmer Labor, Democratic town. Most of the electeds are Democrats. And what I have found is that they are some of the worst purveyors of propaganda. So I want to talk to you about that. Let's talk about that now. It's a bipartisan problem, if you want to put it that way. Can you talk about that a little bit more? I know you talk about it in your book.
This entire book is really about Democrats. It's about academics and universities. It's about nonprofits. It's about, and obviously it's about the news media, but it's about what I think of as more liberal or progressive institutions. I don't actually focus on the right wing or the far right. I think that that kind of propaganda is very interesting and very important, but different kinds of propaganda are directed at different audiences and they have different tools. And so I'm focused in this book, and what I try to give people is the tools to have these conversations within the broad spectrum of, like, you know, the mainstream left, you know, or center and left, right? Within what I would call, you know, a coalition against the sort of rising right-wing authoritarianism in our society. I'm less focused in the book. I do sometimes talk about the right wing, like I'll talk about Fox News or Newsmax or something like that, but only to show people that the propaganda that they're consuming in the New York Times, in the, you know, mainstream papers in Minneapolis and Milwaukee and Pittsburgh, in the sort of standard Democratic Party talking points, like, it's actually doing the same thing as the right wing propaganda. It's teaching you to be afraid of the same people. It's pushing the same solutions, and it's using different words, different framings, different sources that are geared at you, and that are geared at well-meaning people. And so what I try to do in the book is show people that what they think of as more neutral or balanced or liberal news is actually causing the rise of authoritarianism in some key ways. And this is a really, really, really important thing to say, which is that throughout the last 40 or 50 years, I believe the most important contributor to the rise of mass incarceration was these institutions, because they sanitized it. They put a liberal face on these policies. They sold it to people who otherwise would have been absorbed. They sold the largest mass incarceration operation in the history of the world. So right now, the United States puts Black people in jail at 6 times the rate of South Africa at the height of apartheid. We put people in jail generally at 6 times our own historical steady average. This was a very hard propaganda thing to sell. It wasn't as hard to sell to the right wing, right? We now have a lot of unearthed documents that show how the right was thinking about this very explicitly in the 1970s, right? But it was actually a much harder sell to what's called liberal America. And I try to tease apart in the book using examples and jokes, because I think it's important to be funny when we deal with this stuff sometimes, because it's just such a dark topic. But I try to tease apart for people the role that liberal institutions played in selling people what is essentially climate science denial about public safety, pushing policies that make us less safe and more violent and less equal in the name of a safer society. That was a really hard sell, and that's what I focus on.
Yeah, I see it here all the time. I've seen it here the last 2.5 years. I mean, when I ran, I talked about data-based, research-based decisions about what we're doing as prosecutors that theoretically would make us safer. And I think a surprise, and maybe it shouldn't have been a surprise to me, maybe I was really naive about it, some of the biggest obstructionists, the biggest critics of mine have been Democrats. I certainly expected Republicans to do what Republicans do, but it's been very political. And I'm going to give you an example. So very early on in my term, we prosecuted a case where an adult had manipulated a 15-year-old and I think a 17-year-old to go over to a woman's house and kidnap the new boyfriend. The adult was the ex. And so he gave a gun to a 15-year-old who shows up at the apartment, and the woman that was there grabbed a knife. She was defending herself. She did nothing wrong, and kind of came towards the 15-year-old, who did what you would imagine a 15-year-old might do, which is start shooting every which way. He killed her, but he also shot his brother in the leg. So we were going to keep that 15-year-old in the juvenile system. We were not going to certify him as an adult. And it became a big political thing. And one of the things that I remember most vividly about it is this went on for about a month. And one day I got an invite, like a virtual invite from the governor's office. It was the governor, the AG, and me. And one of the first things the governor said to me was that this was getting to be like George Floyd. It might be on CNN. And I had this, like, I thought it would, you know how you think somebody is making a joke, kind of, and you start to laugh, but then you realize they're serious? Had that kind of reaction, because I was just floored that the governor would say that this particular situation, that he would even compare it to Derek Chauvin or George Floyd. Ultimately, the governor did take the case away from us and give it to the AG, but it was all for political reasons. It had nothing to do. Nobody knew anything. He didn't know anything about the 15-year-old, didn't care anything about the 15-year-old. It was all for political appearances. And of course, as you know, sending 15-year-olds to adult prison is extremely damaging to that individual. It makes it much more likely that they're, when they come out, and they will come out, be more of a danger to the public. And so I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Time after time, in city after city all over this country, Democratic Party officials are pursuing flat earther climate science denial type strategies on public safety. And they think that they're doing this because they have to look tough on crime. But what they don't understand is really twofold. Number one, it's a really bad political strategy, because if you create an electorate that is so afraid and starts believing the things you tell it, right? The electorate will eventually start believing these lies if everyone is telling them that more punishment is going to keep them safe. They're actually going to much more significantly support the real deal, the real authoritarian, because the kind of path that a lot of these Democratic elected officials are trying to walk by like scaring the bejesus out of people and blaming poor people and immigrants and strangers and, you know, ignoring the real causes of violence and interpersonal harm, et cetera, and going against the evidence, but then saying, oh, but we should be a little bit, maybe these children should get 50 years in prison and instead of life. You know, that kind of politics is not an inspiring political message for anyone. It doesn't energize a base. It's not true. And so it's actually a very, very difficult set of lies on which to build an effective political movement. I could give many, many, many other examples. But in general, if you convince people of certain lies and scare them a lot, they're going to support the people who they believe are the true, truly zealous and effective, people actually with that worldview. And that's going to be the Republicans, because the Republicans are not only embracing those lies, but they're also able to say, we are ruthlessly and in every way crushing the most vulnerable people in our society, and we want to create this. That's our sort of our brand. The second thing I want to say is, it's deeply damaging to the concept of truth and to the creation of the kind of critical thinking public that we absolutely need if we're going to have a society that doesn't slip into authoritarians. We can't have a public who thinks that the way to solve its problems is through investment in surveillance, in the militarization of police, in prisons for everyone, including teenagers. In like those kinds of interventions are extraordinarily limited. And the evidence from around the world and US history is unbelievably clear. Those things do not, in the short, medium, or long term, make anybody safer. So it's a losing strategy in every sense, and it's also helping to create, in the short, medium, and long term, an electorate that is a base that is much harder for progressives to actually win with, right? Because you've scared people and you've lied to them on what the solutions are to their fears. So these are the moments when you actually need the courage to say, you know what, this is a horrific situation, a horrific tragedy. And the solution to it should be based on the evidence about what makes society safer. And our public safety policy in most places, led by the Democrats, you know, who for the last 40, 50 years have been in charge of most of the state and local governments that have seen these big expansions of policing, prosecution, and punishment. It's been kind of like responding to global warming by doubling down on investments in fossil fuels and Exxon. And it's contrary to everything that we know about the evidence for what do you do when a child harms someone? How do you repair in a community from such an incident? How do you invest to make sure that those kinds of incidents happen less? What kinds of institutions do you create that can truly transform people's lives? Confining a child for decades into a cell where they'll be tortured in solitary confinement, very high chance of sexual and physical assault and abuse, separation from family and loved ones. It's just not the way to create a world where children or adults are doing that kind of thing less. And so if you're a political party that's not willing to say those things, not only are a lot of people just not going to be excited about you and organizing for you and building a political movement for you, but the kind of population that you're helping to create is the kind of population that's ultimately not going to vote for you anyway.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the media's role in that particular case and just in general. You know, there were many, many, many articles, front page stories, and they were pretty much framed as me talking about adolescent brain development and then a family that was mad at me because of what I was proposing to do. And I remember even talking to the reporter, you know, saying, I think reporters, journalists have an obligation to talk to experts, talk about all the things that you just talked about there, instead of creating story after story that just frames it as a family's really upset, and then I'm talking about adolescent brain development.
Yeah, I mean, the media, this is one of the reasons I really wrote the book, right? There's a really important sense in which the news media changes how we all think by how it frames stories and by what context it includes and what context it doesn't include. So you can write a story about this and you can include background about the child's life, background about what happened in the incident, or you can exclude all of that. You can include experts about brain development. You can include experts about the evidence about does it help or hurt public safety in general to put children in adult prison. There's lots of evidence about this. There are experts who study it. But you can also write the story by suggesting that the quote-unquote tough-on-crime approach of just throwing this child into the adult prison system is going to be the way to reduce the number of these incidents in society. You can leave people with that impression. And so I talk a lot in the book about, you know, when you look at a news story, you should be thinking, who brought this story to the reporter? Why is this a news story? But also, who benefits from it? But then even further, who and what benefits from the sources in the story, which sources are included and which sources are excluded, from the word choice, from the context that's provided or not provided. What kind of reader is created by such a story? And what are the typical readers? And by the way, it's not just one story, right? It's when you consume a story like that, you're often consuming 10 stories like that a week, 20 stories like that, you know, every couple of weeks, right? 1,000 stories like that, you know, over the course of a year or two. It changes your brain chemistry and it changes what you think is possible about the world and what you think is real and true about the world. And just by excluding experts on like adolescent brain chemistry from all of those stories, you can create a population that's sort of systemically doesn't understand the connection between, let's say, lead poisoning in neighborhood and impulse control in young people, or the development of a child's brain at 15 and the proper ways of rehabilitating people in different settings, et cetera. So, like, I think that's absolutely vital, and it's incredibly important that we intervene with the local news media to at least get them as a first step to understand what role they play in kind of manipulating how people see reality.
So I want to shift to police, like the Minneapolis Police Department. And there have been plenty of issues documented with that. But one of the things I think about is that it really is the Democrats, a faction of the Democratic Party here in Minneapolis, that makes it very difficult to actually implement any kind of reform or culture shift there. And that is because, and I think this, you see this around the country too, just trying to talk about issues, you are accused of being, or I've been accused of being anti-cop. You know, if I talk about clearance rates, I'm anti-cop. Whereas to me, it's like, okay, clearance rates are really low. That should be a fact that we talk about in the context of public safety. And I sometimes think about, you know, if there was a hospital that had really high infection rates here in Minneapolis and everybody said, hey, we got to figure out why they have high infection rates. Nobody would accuse us of being anti-hospital or anti-doctor. Can you talk about how propaganda has worked, I think, to make it extremely difficult to actually examine the cultural issues and other issues that we see in policing and make it very difficult to even, you know, attempt to do something about them?
This is one of the most salient issues, not just in Minneapolis, but in every major U.S. city. Well, it's almost impossible to have a real conversation about the role of police. People, interestingly, they kind of get this when you talk about other countries. So if you ask people, and I do this all over the country, I ask people, do you think that the police in, let's just say, you know, you pick a country and someone will say, okay, Russia. So I'll say, okay, do you think the police in Russia are primarily concerned with public safety or with serving the interests of the Putin regime? I mean, most people I talk to in liberal circles will say, oh, well, they're obviously doing the bidding of Putin. I mean, they're Putin's police force. Or, you know, you can go on and on. You can, people choose different countries but that they're most familiar with. But it's very easy for people to see in other societies that what the police do, including where they look for crimes, how they devote resources, you know, various types of corruption, are heavily linked to people's understandings of how those societies work and who has power in those societies and who has money, right? So a lot of people will say that they think that Russian oligarchs and the Putin government control a corrupt police force there. It's, for some reason, though, very, very difficult to get people to understand that the major function of local police forces across this country is serving the interests of people in these cities that have a lot of money and power. That is why the major sort of determinant of where policing goes in most of these places is the real estate industry. There are other determinants as well, of course. There are many, many, many powerful interests in each city that play a role in determining things like what surveillance equipment the police have, and et cetera, et cetera. The police unions themselves have become an incredibly powerful political force. In our work across the country, I've interacted with hundreds of local and state officials, Democrats and Republicans. And one thing that comes up among all of them is how much the police threaten them behind the scenes. So, you know, I've had many, many judges and prosecutors and even some attorney general people and city council people, county council people, state legislators all tell me that as soon as they started talking about the police, their family was threatened. Their son was pulled over. Their daughter was searched. They got a call late at night. When I started speaking about the police online, people, anonymous callers started, you know, threatening my family, calling different people in my family late at night, et cetera. This is sort of a silent underworld. I only bring it up to say, there's so much going on beneath the surface that helps explain why local politicians are so afraid to tell the truth about police and why these discussions are so superficial and misleading. There is enormous power in our society in local police. People are very, very afraid of the police. And there's a ton of money at stake. The local police forces are the force that enables real estate investment and gentrification and property values to move in the way that they do. just to take one example, there's obviously many examples of powerful interests that benefit from the way our policing system looks. And so the news media is also at this point where it's been extraordinarily divested from the local reporting. There's not enough reporters in most of these places anymore, right? And so the police, in addition to threatening all these people, and in addition to, you know, a lot of these people who own these news stations also happen to be very wealthy and they have their own political ideology and their own economic interests, but also it's just like the police produce the news for journalists. They don't just send them a list of people that they've arrested. They send them charts, graphs, audio, video, people interview, experts, right? So they can create a whole ecosystem. And so what you have is a situation where you start talking about clearance rates, but the police for the past several years have created a news ecosystem where every single so-called expert that the reporters know about is somebody who's a former cop or connected to the police or whose research is funded by a grant from the police foundation or whatever. And so the news reporter then calls the only expert that they know, and the expert, you know, says something else.
Well, I jump in. I think it's worse than that. I've had this conversation with reporters here, you know, for years, actually, since I've been in office. We have a police chief here in Minneapolis who is refrained. He has press conferences on scenes all the time, and he will say, well, there's a revolving door. These are juveniles committing this crime, and nothing ever happens to them. And, you know, I started saying to press, I started saying out loud, well, how many of those cases were actually submitted to us for charging? You know, why aren't you, media, asking the police chief, you know, did you, even though you might have arrested somebody, did you actually submit that case to us for charging? And then what happened after that? But it seems very rare that media tries to hold the chief accountable for claims that he makes, which simply aren't true. And I see that as a big problem as well. They simply, you know, report what he says, and they don't inquire as to whether there's any basis in fact for that.
Letting people in power just say stuff that is often false is one of the biggest defining features of our current media ecosystem. And in the last chapter of the book, I actually have a list of questions that you can ask your local police chief. And they're questions that any journalist can ask, any city council person can ask, any group of public people can just write and ask these questions and demand that they be answered. And it's really striking that a defining feature of our public discourse in the society is lying by public officials, and the news media either going along with the lie, just reporting the lie with no context. We have a situation where basically what's going on is public officials are saying things like, you know, tobacco doesn't cause cancer, or there is no global warming, right? Or we need more police and that's going to make us safer, right? And nobody is actually following up with, well, wait a second, what is that based on? You know, what about XYZ study? What about all these experts that are saying there's just no confrontation at all? And part of it is this thing I was talking about. In all these local jurisdictions around the country, the police have spent a tremendous amount of time, effort, and money organizing reporters, developing social relationships with them, introducing them to a small but important ball of researchers and professors who are willing to spew the police propaganda. And so I have a lot of suggestions in the book about how do we turn that around in any given community, no matter what your skills are, whether you're a prosecutor or a writer or an artist or a coder or a public defender or, a retired person looking for stuff to do. Like I give advice on how do we intervene in this ecosystem where, as you say, the traditional media is simply functioning as a stenographer for the local police. And I also give you tools for how to point this out every single time it happens. And also little things like paragraphs and citations and quotes you can just kind of insert into each article that give you proper background into what the police are saying. And so, you know, it's been really encouraging as like going around the country and talking to you about this, how many people recognize how broken our local media environment is and are actually taking steps in their own community, whether they're teachers or nurses or doctors or hidden organizers or whatever, who are actually taking steps to develop their own interventions in their local media ecosystem.
Yeah, and I think that that advice is really helpful. I was actually thinking back to, you were talking about business developers, and I was thinking about, you know, we've had the same mayor for 8 years. He's running for another term. And people who support him have been very invested in scaring us about crime in downtown Minneapolis. But at the same time, then people are afraid to come to downtown Minneapolis for Twins games and for stuff like that. So then they've had to urge people to come back downtown. It's safe. It's okay. And it's just been kind of this ping pong, you know, where is the reporting about the fact that a lot of the fear of downtown, as opposed to the reality, but the fear has been created by people with a lot of money, people who support the mayor. And then everybody's, you know, business people are complaining about the lack of people coming downtown. And in large part, it's because of that fear that they've actually created themselves.
One of the interesting things, if you study that kind of reporting and that rhetoric, in that fear-based reporting and the articles about crime and disorder and unhoused people, they actually are not correlated with actual facts. So they don't rise and fall on the number of crimes or arrests or anything like that. They're actually much more correlated with political and economic events. So the ebb and flow of news stories about this stuff is linked to things like elections or votes in city council or approvals of certain economic development projects, etc. And that's one of the most revealing things about our local news. It's not driven by reality. So the number of stories about shoplifting actually is not connected to how much shoplifting is going on. And we now know that, you know, the big retail theft epidemic, for example, over the last few years was actually linked to political and economic battles and not fluctuations in actual instances of retail theft. The same thing is going on with all of that discussion, you know, in Minneapolis. And also, I'll just leave you with this, like, there are a lot of people in our society who benefit when people are afraid. Because when people are afraid, they're much more likely to agree to surveillance, which is very profitable. They're much more likely to agree to authoritarian control. They're much more likely to be unable to think critically, and that benefits people who have power. That's why across societies throughout world history, rulers, whether they're kings or so-called democratic governments, people in power and people who have a lot of money within those systems and a lot of influence, they benefit when most of society is afraid. And so it should be shocking to us that police reported crime is at historic lows and has been going down every single year by decades, and that in spite of that, there is a person in the White House who is claiming that we need to militarize National Guard units and send the military into cities across the country to attack crime. That is only possible, not because of all this right-wing propaganda, but that's only possible because the rest of society, mainstream news, Democratic Party politicians, they have all sowed the seeds of this by creating an irrational fear of only certain kinds of crime and creating a horrific fear in most people's minds about poor people, people of color, immigrants, et cetera, strangers, right? We've created a very fearful society, and there are a lot of people who benefit from it. And so you have to be understanding that connection. Fear sells. And Democrats and MSNBC and the New York Times and your local newspaper, which is you think you read because it's not, you know, a right-wing rag, right? They are doing just as much, if not more, because they are targeting with their propaganda a different audience, an audience who otherwise would want society to look very, very different, much more equal, with investments in things that help people flourish rather than investments that help immiserate people and create pain and isolation and punishment. And that's what I really try to do in the book is walk people through with lots of examples and analysis. You know, it's hard to get into the depth that is required to really change people's minds in, you know, a short interview like this, but I do hope people will take a look at the book. You know, as with everything that I write, all of the royalties are donated to charity, you know, in this case, to a charity that works with unhoused people to fight against police surveillance and brutality. And it's really my goal to get these ideas out there. And that's why we also have free copies for teachers and students and free copies for people in prison. And so, you know, I encourage you to buy a book if you can, because it helps us support the rest of the work. But also, you know, the idea is to spread these ideas and at least get people thinking more critically when they read the news.
Yeah, it's an outstanding book. I think it should be must read for anybody, actually everybody. So thank you for writing the book. I just wanted to end it on another note here. You are a cat person. Is that correct?
I do love me a cat.
How many cats?
Every cat.
What?
I actually am not able to have any cats anymore because I travel so much.
Oh, sure.
So what I end up doing is I end up cat sitting a lot when I am in town. And then I choose which friends I stay with around the country on the basis of how many cats they have in their house. But I don't have any cats that live with me anymore because I'm not around enough in this stretch of my life. How many cats do you have?
Three.
Oh, jealous.
Yeah, I actually have people who work here, friends of mine, who don't like cats, which I don't understand at all.
Oops.
Yeah.
You know, the original draft of this book had a lot of cat photos in it. And I used different facial expressions by cats to throw shade on different journalists and professors and things like that. And the publisher said it was too expensive to print all these cat photos. So they removed all the cat photos from the book. So unfortunately, there's no cat photos in this book anymore. But it is written with a lot of love for cats.
It is. I could tell that. And I'm disappointed. Perhaps at some point you could share the cat pictures that you were going to have in it.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Alec, for your time.
Thank you so much, Mary.